Thank you, Cheryl. Good evening. That's very lovely to be here, as always. We're looking at Chapter 7 of the Tao this week, which is a really great one. I mean, they're all great. So, but before we read through Chapter 7 or Verse 7 and talk about it, I thought we'd just have a small, short offering of our time together. So just taking a moment to move within and softening maybe the shoulders or anything we're holding onto in the body. Remembering to breathe. Breathing through the heels, as the Taoists talk about. And then just tuning in to wherever you feel is your heart center. And then making an internal offering of our time together this evening. May it be in the service of others. May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be at peace. And we'll take a deep breath in. Through the heels, all the way up, and relaxing. Okay, so this is called, what we just did is called a yajna, and we talked about this before when we were looking at the Bhagavad Gita. It's like a consecration or a making sacred of whatever you're doing, and it's seen as part of a karma yoga path of selfless service. And I mention this because chapter or verse 7 of the Tao Te Ching that we're going to look at today talks mainly to selflessness. And it talks to two points I interpret it as about selflessness. One is about selflessness as we think about selflessness sort of on a, I guess, on a one level of, you know, being less selfish and doing more for others and putting others first. But it also sort of implies a deeper meaning of selflessness, of letting go of the self. So it was interesting to me to read different interpretations or translations and see that some leaned on the side of selflessness, of serving others, and others leaned on the side of letting go of the self. So we're going to talk about both this evening, and then hopefully bring it together at the end and see that they kind of interconnect. Okay, so I'm going to start just by reading Wayne Dyer's interpretation or translation of this seventh verse, because he's very much interprets this whole verse about letting, sort of being there for others. So he says, "Heaven is eternal, the earth endures. Why do heaven and earth last forever? They do not live for themselves only. This is the secret of their durability. For this reason, the sage puts himself last and so ends up ahead. He stays a witness to life, so he endures. Serve the needs of others and all your own needs will be fulfilled. Through selfless action, fulfillment is attained." So it's interesting to me, this is very much in line with the Gita's teachings of karma yoga, of you know, selfless action, and that through selfless action, fulfillment is attained, and that's all we need to do. So I thought I would just read a bit of what Wayne Dyer says here, and then share a different interpretation, which is on a similar vein about the serving others. And then we'll talk a little bit about savor, as it's called actually in Sanskrit, which means selfless service. So Wayne Dyer says, being civilized in most cultures primarily constitutes being consumed with attaining success in the acquisition of power and things, which supposedly will provide happiness and prevent unhappiness. The primary idea is of a self who's separate, a separate being in a separate body with a name and with cultural and biological data. that are similar in values and patriotism to others. The Tao is suggesting in this verse that we update those notions and choose to exist for more than ourselves or even our tribe. That is, to radically change our thoughts in order to change our lives. Lao Tzu says the secret of the ineffable nature of the eternal Tao is that it isn't identified with possessions or in asking anything of its endless creations. The Tao is a giving machine that never runs out of gifts to offer, yet it asks for nothing in return. And because of this natural tendency to live for others, the Tao teaches that it can never die. Giving and immortality go hand in hand. This is what I believe the wisdom of this verse of the Tao Te Ching is saying. Make an attempt to reverse the ego's hold on you by practicing the Tao's teachings to serve the needs of others, and all your own needs will be fulfilled. Generously thinking of and serving others will lead to matching your behaviors with the perpetual rhythm of the Tao. Then its power will flow freely, leading to a fulfilling life. Ego wants the opposite, however. It tells you you need to think of yourself first and get yours before someone else beats you to it. And the main problem of listening to the ego is that you're always caught in the trap of striving and never arriving, thus you can never be complete. As you reach out in thoughts and behaviours, you activate loving energy, which is synonymous with giving, putting others ahead of you in many ways as possible by affirming, I see the sacred invisible source of all in its eternal state of giving, and I ask for nothing in return. And when you're tempted to focus on your personal successes, shift instead your attention in that very moment to someone less fortunate. And then he quotes the poet Hafiz, everyone is God speaking, why not be polite and listen to him? So I thought this was sort of an interesting way of just looking at this particular verse, that it's all about offering service to others. And Zalala Towler has a sort of similar translation in that heaven is eternal, earth is eternal. The reason they are eternal is because they do not live for themselves. This is why they are eternal. So the key to eternal life is to live for others. The sage places himself to the rear, yet always ends up at the front. And this comes up a lot in the Tao, this idea of being last, you put yourself first. And not standing on tiptoes is another thing that the Tao talks about. He's not concerned with his own safety, yet he always remains safe. It is not because he is is it not because he is selfless that he is able to realize his true self? So in the act of being selfless, we realize exactly who we are. And that was Zalala Towler's. So I thought it reminded me this week, I was actually writing a different article about savor, or I think you say it's savor, it might be shaver, or some sort of in between the S and the sh. And it's a Sanskrit word for selfless service, and it's part of a path of karma yoga. I thought I'd just share with you about this. And what I was thinking about was Ram Dass. So Ram Dass, the spiritual teacher, while he was studying with his guru, Maharaji, and it's a story he often tells, so you might have heard it. He says to Maharaji, how do I raise my kundalini? And Maharaji replies, feed others, serve everyone. And so that wasn't really what Ram Dass says he wanted to hear at the time. But he understood that in order to have this sort of spiritual evolution or go through a spiritual evolution, he had to put others first instead of thinking even of his own spiritual path. Instead of thinking of sitting down and raising his kundalini, it would be more helpful to him to go out and think of others, which is kind of interesting because on a spiritual path, we cannot help but think of our own awakening and our own enlightenment and our own path. And we can become sort of almost competitive or judging around where others are and where we are and then judging of ourselves that we're not where we should be. So I thought this idea of selflessness also applies very much to that that perception that we can sort of get lost in sometimes. So I'm just going to read you some of the things that I wrote about the selfless service. So while many of us feel drawn to help others, I know that many of my friends are drawn to others, and when you're on a spiritual path, a lot ourselves talks about a lot of a great part of us wants to be able to help others find the peace that we have, that we achieve sometimes. But our thinking mind, or really our ego, then tends to drop in and voice its thoughts. So it's really hard, I find, with selfless service. It sounds like it's going to be very easy, but we can often think about recognition, or we can very subtly think that people will think better of us, or that we will be better spiritual students, or that God will look down kindly on us if we are doing good. And so the brain sort of starts to get a bit muddy, or rather the mind gets muddy. And then the ego can often sort of jump in and judge how we serve others and tell us that some types of service are more noble than others. So, helping your neighbor cross the street may not seem as noble to your ego as going out and feeding the 5,000, perhaps, or, working at a soup kitchen and impacting 100 people, 200 people. And unfortunately, when that happens, we don't let ourselves be moved by the Tao and put to service where is needed. We actually, in that moment, have the mind step in and tell us, the ego step in and tell us what it thinks is needed. So it's really sort of a beautiful practice, selfless service, which you begin to, if you're contemplating it and really sort of on it, you begin to see these subtleties about the difference between having the mind tell you and the ego tell you what is selfless service and what you need to do, and then just sort of resting back in the center or the Tao or the heart and asking where you could be of most service. Another thing that sort of impacts us when we're thinking of selfless service is that we often get disappointed that our efforts didn't culminate in quite the life-changing results we wished for. I know sometimes often when we're thinking about putting others first, we perhaps even expect them to benefit. And even that isn't selfless service, even just expecting others to somehow be improved or have their lives change for the positive in some way itself is coming with this ego. And then many of us often find that our ego is all too ready to tell us that we have failed. So that becomes another sort of challenge or practice that arises within selfless service. But really, when we start to practice or serve with the essence of savor in mind, so really sort of coming from our heart, we can become the watcher. And this particular verse we'll see in a different translation is asking us to be the one who watches. It's asking us to be the witness. And that sort of comes into letting go of the self, of being selfless, that we're going to talk about in a minute. So as I say, when we start to have sort of this essence of savor in our daily lives, so in every moment, and we all talk about, not all of us, I guess, but we often talk about this idea of asking every moment, what would you have me do? What would you have me say? That really is savor. That's like selfless service, because you are giving up your sense of self and allowing something else to come through you to put you to use. But we may do that and then, as I say, add on a layer of expectation of, oh, well, I gave up myself and I'm following the guidance of wisdom. So why didn't it work out perfectly? And then so that's just the mind coming back in. So we begin to see when we do this practice, whether it's at the beginning, as I say, of asking where would you have me be, or it's noticing that we feel like it wasn't quite good enough, or we didn't get the recognition we wanted, or it didn't work out the way we wanted, we begin to see the way that the ego stands in front of the heart. And actually, in the gentle contemplation, one day I'll get it right, gentle healing, gentle healing on Tuesday evenings with Regina. The lesson that we did today in the workbook was actually looking at how grievances can stand in front of miracles. And I feel that's sort of it's a similar idea of this idea of the ego standing in front of the heart, so not allowing us to sort of act from this place of pure love and no judgment, because it has its own judgments there. Consistent, healing, gentle healing group, thank you. I always get consistent and contemplation mixed up. Thank you, Cheryl. And what happens is that when we let go of ego, and this is something that I realized this week that was kind of mind-blowing for me, that when you let go of the ego, you begin to see that we are naturally kind. I have gone through a lot of my life thinking that I need to be kinder, I need to serve others, to become more kind, I need to practice kindness. And in my practice of kindness, I will become more of my true essence. Sort of this, I just can't think of a better word, but like arse about face way of attacking that problem. If I practice being kinder, I will become kind. Instead, when we practice savor, what happens is that we realize that our natural state of being is kind. Our natural state just wants to serve. And so there's nothing that we need to do. We don't need to listen to the ego telling us we could be doing this, and we need to join this volunteer organization, and we need to go out and plant bulbs for the neighborhood, we need to do this, we need to do that. Really, all we need to do is go inside and ask, you know, where can I be put? And if we don't hear anything, then my suggestion is that we just, you know, go out and do it anyway, and then hopefully we'll hear it. By meeting the universe, by just going out there and putting that out there, we'll begin to hear more of where we're guided to be a greater service. So in this way, sort of our service is like much less contrived and much more authentic, and therefore becomes more purposeful and more helpful, because we don't know where we should be best placed to serve. And what they talk about in the Bhagavad Gita is something called Svadharma. So seva puts you in touch with your Svadharma, which means your individual purpose. In that when we start to ask for guidance of within, we are moved to act from the depths of the greater Dharma. So it's I always think of, you know, the Tao and Dharma as being sort of similar, in that it's just sort of moving into what the greater whole would have you do. And within that, we are, you know, acting as individuals, and we come with, I'm sort of wary to say we come with special gifts. I'd say that we each have abilities and talents that suit us more, that then are put to work better in certain situations than others, or can be more of service than others. And so they sort of move together, this individual Dharma, the Svadharma, and the Dharma come together. Or another way of saying it is by allowing the Dharma to move through you, or to be aligned with the Dharma, aligned with the Tao, that your individual Dharma emerges. And people often talk about, oh, what's my purpose in life? And really, your purpose is, this is just my opinion, the purpose is to align with the greater purpose. So align with the Tao, align with the Dharma. And then your individual purpose, it doesn't even matter. You don't even think about it. I mean, you know, you don't need your ego to get involved in it. You will just be guided to do what suits you best in this world. And Sri Swami Satchidananda says, Svadharma is something completely natural to you that you could do to benefit others. Feel the unseen hand directing you every minute, which to me is exactly the same as the Tao. Feel the unseen hand directing you every minute. Feel the Tao. And know that what comes from that place is always unplanned by you. So it has nothing to do with you. There is no way your mind can know what it is. And it will always, always be for the good of everybody. So when the mind starts to kick in and say, well, I don't know if that helped as much as I wanted, and I asked inside, but then that's what I was told to do, but I feel like it went badly, it's for the good of everybody, and you just have to sort of let go of that ego judgment and just, you know, step back into the Tao and understand that if you came from that place, it is for the good of everyone. So that was kind of sort of one angle, of this particular verse. And I just wanted to read you a couple of comments by Salala Taylor on this passage. The sage, or the self-realized one, does not strive to be at the head of the pack. In fact, they prefer to lead from behind. By putting themselves at the back, they end up in a leadership position. The sage is selfless. By not putting himself forward, by not worrying about his safety, and by not calling attention to himself, he is able to realize his true self, and that's called Zenren in Taoism. This is what a sage is. The ancient sages slept without dreaming and awoke without anxiety. Their food was not fancy and their breathing was deep. With this kind of person, their mind is free, their spirit is calm, and their brow is smooth. They're as cool as autumn, yet as warm as spring. Their joy and anger happen naturally like the four seasons. They're at harmony with all things and experience themselves as having no limits. Lao Tzu tells us that the sage does not fear for his own safety and therefore always remains safe. He thinks little of himself and always loves others, says Master Ho Shan Kung. Not only that, but all the people love him like their father and mother. The spirits protect him like a little child. So it was sort of interesting to me that, and it's sort of a light, you know, is in line with what I was saying about unnatural self being kind and love and giving, that when we step away from wanting to be those things, trying to be those things, putting ourselves first, like a sort of a different way of looking at it, then we naturally sort of fall into alignment with that loving, giving part of ourselves. And because we do, we sort of realize the eternal nature of our being and become, you know, happy and joyful and happy to be around, and therefore become an influence in people. So without wanting to and or aspiring to, it's like a natural happening. But the other part that I really sort of, the other interpretation of this particular verse is really, really speaks to me, and that is of letting go of the self. So I'm just going to read two different translations. One is Stephen Mitchell's, which I find is always a little drier than all the others and therefore is actually quite helpful sometimes. And so it reminds us at the beginning, the Tao is infinite and eternal. Why is it eternal? It was never born, thus it can never die. Why is it infinite? It has no desires for itself. Thus it is present for all beings. So in the selflessness of not wanting anything for ourselves and putting others first, we can be present for all beings. The master stays behind, and that's why she is ahead. She is detached from all things, and that is why she is one of them, because she has let go of herself. She is perfectly fulfilled. So I wanted to talk a little about this idea of letting go of the self, of becoming detached, and having no desires for ourselves, and the idea of that being selflessness, of letting go of self with a little s. And I was reading something by Jack Kornfield, who was talking about this particular thing, and he says, there are often misconceptions about selflessness and emptiness. And if you remember, the Tao talks about becoming empty, and when you move into alignment with the Tao, you're in this void. And Buddhism, which Jack Kornfield follows, talks a lot about emptiness. And he sort of says that selflessness and emptiness are pretty much the same. It's letting go of this small self. And he says a lot of confusion happens around this that can undermine spiritual development. And that some people believe they can come to selflessness by struggling to get rid of their ego-centered self. And others confuse the notion of emptiness with unworthiness or meaningless, and they carry that into a spiritual practice. He says some sort of try to bypass life's problems by just sort of withdrawing from life and calling themselves empty. But he says that this really misses the true meaning of selflessness and emptiness. To try to get rid of the self, he says, to purify, to root out, to transcend all desire, anger, centeredness, to vanquish a self that is bad, is an old religious idea. This notion underlies the ascetic practices such as wearing hair shirts, I had never heard of hair shirts, extreme fasting and self-mortification that are found in many traditions. Sometimes such practices are used skillfully to induce altered states, but often they reinforce aversion. However, what is worse is what comes with them, a notion that our body, mind and ego is somehow sinful, dirty and deluded. I, the good part of me, we say, must use these techniques to get rid of the bad part of me, the self. But this can never, ever work. It can never work because there is no self to get rid of. And this is the sort of the gem, I think, of what he's saying here. We are a changing process and not a fixed being. There never was a self. Only our identification makes us think so. So while purification and kindness and attention and offering to be selfless can improve habits, what happens is we must never confuse that with letting go of the self. It's entirely different because the self was never really there. And I'm reading Self-Observation by Red Hawk, and it talks a lot about the Gurdjieff teachings, about this very thing that we often get confused of. You know, spiritual path, and I'm going to let go of the self. And we think it exists. We think there is this one self we're going to get rid of, and we think, well, we'll do yajnas, and we'll be kind, and we'll do selfless service, like seva, and somehow we're getting rid of the self. Now, seva, I'd argue, you are, because you're moving into this place of the Tao. You're not even in the mind, and that there is no small self. But often, when we're not coming from this sort of deep place of understanding of selfless service, we're just reinforcing the ego. And we're answering sort of parts of the mind that are really fragmented. And there is no cohesive self in which to get rid of. So I'm just going to read you what Red Hawk says about it. He says, one of the hardest ideas to understand the claim that we are not a unified being inside a single eye, but actually a multitude of eyes inside, a self-divided, fragmented into dozens, even hundreds of fracturing eyes with a little eye, each with its own agenda, tone, mood, and beliefs. It's impossible to understand this right away in any way except intellectually, he says. I believe I am one, whole, undivided, and I constructed in such a way psychologically that the truth of my inner state is impossible for me to see. Psychology has labelled such a state schizophrenia, yet it is a state of the entire human race. And he says everyone I've ever met, without exception, suffers from this inner state. But we cannot admit to such a thing because to do so would place us in such jeopardy. And you can imagine, well, I could imagine this, just sort of sitting down and really taking a look and seeing all these fragments and arguing and conflicting parts of ourselves that form no cohesive one Helen, in my case, which is a scary thing to think about. they have a place for people like that, he says. So to avoid being shot or jailed or placed in an institution, we have all developed elaborate disguises, masks, acts, games, false personalities to hide our real inner state of fragmentation. And I will fight against it in any way to defend it against attack or exposure. I am a mass of contradictions. I see this in others, and often it's very obvious, and I have no idea why they don't see it in themselves. And when I point it out to them, they get quite annoyed and defensive, he says. It's a surprise. But I cannot believe that inside I am shattered and fragmented state. And the result is that I act as if myself and everyone else were a whole, united, single, stable, unchanging I within. Thus, if X says she's going to do something and the next day she doesn't do it, I'm insulted and angry, and I believe her to be a liar and not to be trusted. I may even end my friendship with her if the insult is great enough. And we end relationships all the time over petty grievances. Why? Because in the first place, we believe the other to be the same I always and in every circumstance. And secondly, because I myself am governed by many small I's, each with its own agenda, and one of them, full of self-importance and unable to value my friendship, decides to end it. It thinks for me, speaks for me, acts in my name. And having done so, the damage may be irreparable. I may pay for the rest of my life for the momentary impulsive action of a small I in me, which the next moment or the next hour or the next day is no longer in charge and has in fact disappeared. So it just kind of blew my mind. And if you ask me the next day why on earth I said and did such thing to X, I will tell you quite honestly, I don't know. I just don't know what I was thinking. Or else I will blame X and then justify my behaviour towards her with the most transparent and obvious falsehoods and excuses. This is my state, and this is the state of every single person I have ever met, he says, without exception. And the state of fragmentation runs my life. It's why I cannot follow a single line of action to its logical conclusion, especially if such a line of action must be carried out over a long period of time. Days, months, or even years. So imagine that. That's our whole life. Okay, and skip this bit. It says, never minding the consequence to self or others, each of these eyes wants only what it wants, when it wants it, and how it wants it. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead, it says, and it's happening in me every moment of every day for my entire life. And not just me, all of us. Oh my goodness, how many small eyes are running around? One small eye will take control of the instrument momentarily, will choose for me, will speak in my voice, will act in my name, and my whole life and the direction of my life may hinge on that small and seemingly insignificant moment. And I, the big eye, am not even present. I don't even know what happened, and the implications for me, the importance of the choice, none of that. I'm not present. I'm not aware. Once a multitude of eyes in me has chosen, decided with finality and certitude, a life-changing decision, I am no longer there. The little eye, which chose the agenda, and they each have their own. So I was thinking about this today, I wonder what example I would use. And an hour before now, well, a little over an hour, I got an email. Well, I emailed my... Well, the story is that I gave a hard drive, an external hard drive, to my IT department. They took, they wanted my laptop back to do some amendments on it. And I said, well, there's a couple of things on there. I'm going to give you this hard drive, external hard drive, for you to get them off while you're doing it. And they were quite urgent and persistent about this. And they even emailed my boss and got me in a bit of trouble for not coming in. So I went in and I gave them this. And I said to him, this is my external hard drive, and it has 12 years of my life in New York on it. Like, you're gonna look after it. And they said, yes, here it is. It's in a locked drawer. You can see it. And I said, well, I know you're moving offices. So they said, this will be done in 3 days. And this was a month ago. And I thought, well, I'll leave them. You know, they've got a lot on. I didn't hear from them, and I knew the move was coming, and I emailed them and said, hope you have everything's going okay. And they said, we haven't forgotten. your drive is here safe. And I said, okay, I'm worried about the move. And they said, don't worry, you'll get it back before the move. And I didn't. And they moved and I didn't hear from them. And this tonight, I emailed them and said, hey, any news on the drive? And they came back and said, we lost it. Something very interesting happened in that I felt like a lot of heat in the center of my chest, like a lot. And I felt that I should be really angry about this. But there was part of me that just thought, well, you know, it's gone. What are you going to do? It's gone now. It's absolutely gone. You can't do anything about it. And then another little eye, one of these multitudes of eyes, popped up and said, look at you. Aren't you forgiving? How wonderful of you to forgive. That's wonderful. And then another part of that popped up and said, look, there's your ego. It's telling you you're doing good things. That's bad. That's bad. And then another eye popped up and said, well, you know what? That's okay that you can forgive him, but he doesn't sound like he feels bad. Not bad enough anyway. And I just observed them all and thought, oh my God, I would drive myself crazy. I have such a choice here of what to follow, which one? And I was observing them, so I knew I wasn't going to follow any of them, or at least try not to. So I emailed him and I was still caught up in a bit of these voices. And so I said, you know, Neil, I really can't process this right now. I'm kind of a bit like blown away by this acknowledgement you've lost it. I'll get back to you. And then Neil replied and said, I cannot tell you, I feel sick to my stomach that this has happened, Helen. I'm so sorry. And without, you know, even thinking about it, I just emailed him back and said, you know, these things happen and don't worry about it. Like, it's not worth feeling sick over. It's just data. It's gone. It's fine. And again, all these voices rose up and said, well, it didn't sound like he was that sorry. And he didn't respond to this email. So then another voice was like, well, he hasn't even responded to this email. He's probably down the pub. And all they went on and on again. And so it went on. And I thought, how interesting that to look upon these, not as just random thoughts, but actually the multitudes of little eyes, and how in any one moment we can become one of them. And then our whole life changes because of it. So it was really fascinating to me. And in the end, I just tried to just keep coming back to this sense of, which really was like, I'm not bothered. I feel like I should be more bothered, and that's just my mind going, but I'm not that bothered. And even I didn't almost felt like I didn't want to talk about it, because I felt that by talking about it, I'm in some way adding some layer to this that I then will have to shed. But I wanted to share it because I thought it was a good example of these multitude of eyes. So one of the translations, as I mentioned, talks about this verse actually talking about being the watcher. So I wanted to just read that translation. And it's interesting, this translation is William Martin, and his translations are completely different to any of the others. And he starts off like everyone else. How can we find the eternal, the lasting nature of the Tao that seems so elusive amid the changes of life? The Tao does not come and go as do all formations. It is the watcher of the comings and the goings. In our practice, we find that we are the watcher as well. We watch our opinions and ideas, our likes and dislikes, our desires and our fears, our bodies and our minds, but we do not identify with them. Therefore, when they arise, we watch. And when they pass away, we remain. And I just love this because, you know, as all these other translations are saying, heaven is eternal. And why do they last forever? Because they do not live for themselves. And here we're saying that is effectively when you watch and let things go, then we remain. That's why we're eternal, because the watcher is always there, just always there. And then he says, this watching is not at all dispassionate. We are allowed to feel anything and everything. And this comes back to this idea of not judging the ego or are not sort of getting caught in all those other little eyes that pop up of, oh, look how great you're doing, and oh, no, you're not doing, and stuffing things down or pretending they're not there. Just feeling everything and seeing everything. We are merely advised not to identify with anything that is transient. And all these multitudes of eyes are completely transient and contradictory, but they are transient. And the feelings and emotions are transient. And our opinions are transient. Our personalities are even transient. We often think our personalities are like rigid, but they're transient and the situations are transient. So for instance, he says, notice the subtle difference between I'm feeling fear and I am afraid. And becoming the watcher is the practice of sitting in that sense of, okay, I can see or that I'm feeling fear, or I'm observing that I'm feeling fear, which is different to the identification, which would be I am afraid. And I had a yoga teacher that used to say, it was a bizarre way of speaking, but she always used to say, anger has arisen. It was never, I am angry. She would just, it was almost like her talking in the third person. Anger is present. So that meant you've pissed me off. But it was a nice way of not identifying it. I'm not sure she was just saying, I'm not sure whether she really didn't feel identified with it or whether it was just a way of pretending not to be identified. So he suggests having a look at, are there any feelings or situations at the moment you notice you are identifying with rather than merely experiencing? So I thought that was really interesting. Okay. And then I thought I'd just share something for the wonderful Byron Katie before we wrap up for the evening. Unless anyone has anything they wanted to talk about or share at all, feel free to put your hand up or mention it in the room if you do. Okay. All right then. So, and we've got a bit of time, so I think I'm just going to read everything she says. And she talks about the entire verse here. What is death? How can you die? Who says that you were ever born? There is only the life of an unquestioned thought. And this is sort of putting yourself in the who am I, who had the thought, whose ego. There is only mind, if anything. After you think the thought, I'm going to die, where did that thought go? It's like that I, where did that I go? That little I. Isn't another thought your only proof that it's true? Who would you be without your story? That's how the world begins. It starts with an I, then becomes an I am, then becomes I am a woman, I am a man, then becomes I am a woman who gets up to brush her teeth and go to work, and on and on and on until the world becomes denser and denser. And I thought this was interesting. We often talk about a dense world, and it's these layers of identification that we add on. I am, just question that. That is where the world ends. Until what's left comes back to explore the next concept. Do you continue after death? If you question your mind deeply enough, you'll see that what you are is beyond life and death. And again, just to remind you, heaven is eternal and the earth endures. This verse. The questioned mind, because it is no longer seeking, is free to travel limitlessly. It understands that since it was never born and can never die, it is infinite. It has no desires for itself. It withholds nothing. It's unconditional, unceasing, and fearless and tireless without reservations. And that's, we've talked about this before, it's like this well that just keeps on giving and giving. That's its nature, and since all beings are its own dear reflected self, it is always receiving and giving back to itself. A stuck mind is the only death, because it's death by torture. The unquestioned mind, believing what it thinks, lives in dead ends, frustrated and hopeless, forever trying to find a way out, only to experience another dead end. And that's these eyes, these conflicting eyes, little eyes we talked about that are running around causing havoc. They arise and then they go and they conflict with another one that comes up and a different one tomorrow. And every time the problem is solved, another problem arises. That's how the unquestioned mind has to live. It has to live. It can only live that way. It's stuck in the older stories like a dinosaur still chewing on the same old grass. And she says, when I woke up, awakened in 1986, I noticed stories arising inside me that had been troubling mankind forever. Which is so interesting to think that we're all just regurgitating these same old stories. I felt committed to undoing every stressful story that had been told. I was the mind of the world, and every time one of the stories was seen for what it really was and thus undone in me, it was undone in the whole world, because there is only one thinker. And you may be familiar with Byron Katie's work, The Work. And that's what she does now. The master stays behind, remember this part from the verse, in the student's position. And we've talked about this before, and I just love it. It was Arnaud Desjardins who says that all he's ever wanted to be was not a teacher, but the best disciple he could ever be. And I just really, really love that. So always watching, that's what the master does, noticing, experiencing, realizing, and enveloped in reality in the way of it. That's how she stays ahead of any problem. There's nothing wasted, nothing unabsorbed, nothing is left out. She is detached from all things in the sense that when they come, that's what she wants. And when they go, that's what she wants. It's all fine with her. So I love this. I really wanted this external hard drive so I can save all my photos. Oh, it's gone. That's fine too. It's all fine. I'm not quite there, but it's all fine. She's in love with it as it comes and as it goes. She is one with all, says Byron Katie. The branch sways in the breeze. As she watches, she sees that it's not true. And in that lack of separation, she becomes the branch in the breeze. I love that. She hears the sound of the garbage truck and becomes the sound, and she tingles with gratitude that she is that. What self is there to let go of? The world begins with her and it ends with her right now. So I thought that was really lovely. And that's really it for this evening. So I just want to read what Cheryl wrote in the room here. Forgiveness removes only the untrue, lifting the shadows from the world and carrying it safe and sure within its gentleness to the bright world of a clean and new and clean perception. And that's from A Course in Miracles. Forgiveness, yeah. So awareness. I always think of forgiveness as being just the same as awareness. It removes the untrue. So becoming the watcher. If I was to translate this into the Tao, lifts the shadows from the world. Okay, great. So I'm going to play, talking of service, I thought I would play Servant of Peace by Satam Kaur, where she sings, Lord, make me an instrument, I believe. This is part of this one. Okay, so I'll just play this and then we'll just wrap up the other side. But thank you very much. It's always lovely to be here. And I hope you enjoy this song.
Sugar. Shine today, all the stars.
Okay, yeah, I love that song too, Cheryl. And what I really get from it and from this whole verse in the Tao is that to truly be selfless, to sort of have that selfless service and be in the world and not putting ourselves first, all we need really do is just keep going inside and discerning who we are, letting go of who we think we are and stepping into to who we truly are. So thank you very much. I hope you all have a really lovely week. Blessings to you all, and I'm sure I'll see you in here at some point. And I'm going to pass you back over to Cheryl and then on to Doreen. So thank you. Have a lovely evening.